Well, can I add my welcome to Mark? It's great to have you here with us for what is the climax in our series, Questions for Life. In this series, we have been considering some of the big questions of life. If you've been with us, perhaps you've been listening in. But sooner or later, the question that people ask is, well, why should we listen to what the Bible has to say about these kinds of issues, questions of life? We can't trust the Bible, people say. I mean, there are so many issues, and people have issues with its authority, issues with its morality, issues with its reliability, issues with its trustworthiness, issues with its relevance. Richard Dawkins puts it like this, and you'll see there on the sheet there's a little quote which I'm going to read out for us from The God Delusion. To be fair, much of the Bible is not systematically evil, but just plain weird, as you'd expect of a chaotically cobbled together anthology of disjointed documents, composed, revised, translated, distorted, and improved by hundreds of anonymous authors, editors, and copyists unknown to us, and mostly unknown to each other, spanning nine centuries. Well, we might not quite put it like that, but do you see the issue? How do we defend the Bible against those kind of charges on those kind of issues? Well, the answer comes in the Bible, in the passage that was read out for us from Luke's account. But then at that point, maybe we have an objection, or our culture does, and says, well, we can't look to the Bible for the answer, because that means that it's circular. If the Bible itself says it is trustworthy, which we'd expect, well, we can't listen to that. That makes it a circular argument. Well, I'd like to suggest that it has to be circular. It is circular of necessity. And that is true for all prior commitments, all prior worldview, all belief systems, all philosophies, all ultimate authorities. You've got to trust somebody. We live in a culture that is very suspicious, and you can understand why. We're suspicious of authority figures. We're suspicious of government, and we think of the expenses scandal, and we think of the dirty dossier in Iraq a few years ago. And we're suspicious of the media and the entertainment world as well. We think of the phone hacking fiasco, and we think of fake news and Weinstein and things like this. And we're even suspicious of the church with the abuse scandals, inquiries. But unless you are an extreme cynic or conspiracy theorist who thinks you should go hide away in some kind of nuclear bunker in Switzerland, well, we all trust in something or somebody. We all believe, we all trust in somebody, something. Even if all we do is decided it's better off for us to trust in ourselves or those close to us. In fact, we do this every day. You did it today. You got up out of bed and you came to work and you trusted TfL or Southern or whoever it is that got you to work. Actually, if you do travel by Southern, maybe you shouldn't trust them. But we decide who we trust every day in life. But the big question is, who do we trust ultimately? We all have an ultimate authority because we all have something or someone that we base our lives upon. Something or someone that we are committed to, ultimately, a prior commitment. Let me try to explain. For some of us, that is God or Allah or many gods or whoever we would call him or her, however else we would express it. That is the way we reason. And if that is not the case, if it is not God, well, then we say it is reason or experience when it comes down to it. Because we all have something or someone that is our ultimate authority. For example, someone says, I am a follower of the Jedi religion. And at that point, maybe you think you've seen too many movies. But you ask, well, why do you trust that? Well, they say, because I've had this experience of the Force. I felt it. Well, experience is the ultimate authority in that instance. Or maybe an atheist says, I believe in science, evolution, the multiverse theory, and I think I reason that that explains everything. And I reasoned that we do not need God in that context. Well, you ask, well, why do you trust that conclusion? Why do you think that is a right thing to conclude? And they say, well, I applied my mind to it. I reasoned it. Reason, our reason then, is the ultimate authority. Because you can't appeal to a higher authority than an ultimate authority. That is the truth for everything. It's true for everything in life. And the same principle then applies to the Bible. Now, I'm not saying that that is proof, but I am saying that this is a start. And at this point, we have all got trust issues. Because we need to ask the question, what authority is it that we are basing our lives upon? The question becomes, can we really trust whatever it is that we are trusting in? Whether it's experience or reason or whatever. And then I want to ask, are we sure? Are we 100% sure? And are we 100% sure that the Bible isn't reliable? That it isn't trustworthy? Can we say that? And so I'd like to encourage us to have an open mind on these things. And to look at what the Bible has to say. And to test it. And to see if what it says actually stacks up. We're going to do that now. We're going to look at Luke's account. So why should we trust the Bible? Well, first of all, our first heading there on the sheets, trustworthy testimony. In our hands here, we have Luke's account of Jesus' life. And he was a medical doctor. And that means that he is educated. And what he wants us to do is to cross-examine the evidence. In fact, that's what he did. He cross-examined the eyewitnesses. He interviewed them. So let's play CSI Judea. And if you've lost the place, we are on page 3 of this little white booklet, this copy of Luke's account. Here we see there are sources. There are eyewitnesses, verse 1. They saw what happened among them. They were there at the beginning and they saw it all, verse 2. And they are described here as ministers. That is, their job was to record and pass on this message. And they did that job. And the message spread all over the world like wildfire, and is still spreading today. But that is not all. Because in verse 3, he says he had a method. Verse 3, it was carefully researched. He says he followed it, all these things, closely. And he says it was carefully ordered as well. He says what he wrote down for us is an orderly account, verse 3. Well, what does that mean? Well, I think it does mean there is a chronology, an order of events, which starts in Galilee and starts with his birth and ends in his death and resurrection in Jerusalem. Real places in history. But I think it means something else as well. I think it means that there was a theological order. Not just that he got the right details in terms of people and places, but an order theologically. And what that means then is that he gives the interpretation, the meaning of these events, a purpose for writing. And he tells us what that purpose is in verse 4. Take a look down. That you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. He wants us to have certainty, confidence in this message, what was taught, to know that these events really did happen in history and that they really do have a meaning. And the way he goes on to write fits exactly with that, as he gives names of people and places from history. So look over the page to chapter 2. You'll need to turn over a few pages. And we're on page 8 there. And take a look at chapter 2 and verses 1 to 2. Let me read it for us. We're on page 8. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to be registered, each to his own town. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David. He gives us the postcode of Jesus Christ's birth. Nazareth, Galilee. He tells us who was in charge, who was in government at the time, the governor, Quirinius. and he gives us names. He gives us the names also of Jesus in a circle as we read on, men and women. Now, apparently, the top two boys' names in the UK last year were Oliver and Mohammed. And the top two girls' names were Olivia and Sophia. Well, the academic Richard Baucom has looked at what it was in the first century. And it turns out that the two most popular names, male and female, are Simon, as in Simon Peter, Jesus' right-hand man, and Mary, one of Jesus' inner circle. Now, that fits the Bible account as well. So we get names of the inner circle, but we also get the names of the minor characters in the story. Why do that? Well, we get the names of the minor characters in chapter 19, like Zacchaeus and Simon the Pharisee. Stuff, actually, that he doesn't need to tell us unless it actually happened and these were real people. C.S. Lewis wrote the Narnia stories and he knew something about legends and myths. And he was also an Oxford professor in medieval history. And he wrote this. I have been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends and myths all my life. I know what they are like. I know none of them are like this. Of this text, there are only two possible views, he writes of the Bible. Either this is reportage, or else some unknown ancient writer without known predecessors or successors suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic, realistic narrative. Do you see what he's saying? He's saying, go and read the ancient myths and legends. Well, they don't read like this, like the New Testament. But Dr. Luke says, I did the research. Every detail tells a story. And so therefore, the reasonable thing, the scientific thing even, is to go and read it for ourselves and see where the evidence, that evidence, takes us. But then at that point, an objection comes. Yes, but how do we know that what they wrote down, that they got it right? The problem of time. We all know the problem with memory. It is the problem of fading memories. The problem of time. Let me illustrate this. My uncle was in Holland, was an expert witness at the trial of the man accused of being the Nazi war criminal, Ivan the Terrible. Ivan had committed terrible atrocities in an extermination camp. But the problem was whether people's memories after all those years were reliable enough to identify the man on trial, John Demjanjuk, as Ivan the Terrible. After all, you know the problem. Memories, they fade. Well, how do we answer that? Well, for starters, the events of Jesus' life were so memorable. His death and resurrection, you wouldn't forget that. The feeding of the 5,000, you wouldn't forget something like that. And his teaching, very memorable as well. People are able to quote it even today. But especially Dr. Luke tells us this in verse 2. He tells us that he wrote it down whilst the eyewitnesses were still alive. He interviewed them, he spoke to them. And he did that with a purpose, that we might have certainty. But then another objection comes. Another time problem. Okay, but how do we know for certain that we still have today what they wrote down? How do we know that? I mean, maybe, as people suggest, there are problems that have occurred. Errors have crept in. And lots of editors and people have come in and edited it and made tweaks, and some of those are innocent and some less so. Well, here is the important thing that we learn from this, actually. And there's a diagram that I'm happy to make available to you, which we can email round to you, which you'll be able to look at, which shows us the number of copies that there are of the New Testament documents. The first copy of Harry Potter's book went for £40,000 to £50,000. I don't know if anyone here has got a copy, anyone that committed from the early days queuing up to get that book. Now, we don't have a copy of the first edition of the New Testament. We don't have that. But that is true for all Old Testament documents. So all old books. But what we do have is lots and lots of copies. And when you start looking at some of the old pieces of literature, like the Iliad, that people don't question whether it is historically reliable, whether we still have the original of what was written down, because we only have copies. Well, we have many, many more copies, thousands of copies of extracts and whole copies of the New Testament. And the gap between those copies and the original when it was written down is much shorter in fact. And so we've got lots of evidence for the New Testament. But then another objection comes. Another objection, that is the problem of translation. And someone says, well, that was 2,000 years ago, longer for the Old Testament, and the originals were written in other languages, Hebrew for the Old Testament and Greek for the New Testament. And what we've got is in English, and maybe it's been lost in translation. In 1877, the Italian astronomer Giovanni Virginio Schiaparelli, someone will have to tell me if I got that right, began mapping the planet Mars. And he thought he'd spotted channels, so he labelled them as channels, and he did that in Italian and wrote down canali. Unfortunately, that got translated canals. Venice on Mars, get out your boat. And the US astronomer Percival Lovell was so convinced that he mapped many more, and actually what he then did was publish 3 books on Mars with illustrations in them, with canals built by Martian engineers. Well, do you see the problems there of translation? Embarrassing when it's something like that, but some are much more serious. Because when it comes to the Bible, the stakes are so much higher. It's about heaven and hell, life or death, certainty or doubt. Actually, when it comes down to it, though, when we look at the Bible, the translations that we have is not so much a problem, but an advantage. Because as we look at the old languages, the translations into old languages like Coptic and Syriac and other ancient languages, we can cross-check them against what we have in the Greek and in the Hebrew and in our English versions. And we see that they say the same thing, substantively. In fact, that was what the Reformation was all about. At the time of the Reformation, 500 years ago, the translators went back to the Greek, and they looked at it and they found certain changes that had crept in medieval times that were wrong, and they made corrections. And that was what happened during the Reformation, as the Bible was not so much lost in translation, but refound in translation. So here we have trustworthy testimony. But that's not all, because it's not enough to stop here. Secondly then, testimony of and about Jesus Christ. We see this at the end of Luke's account, and if you'd like to turn with me to page 79, and I'm going to read for us that section that you'll see there, the editors have put in, Jesus appears to the disciples. Let me read from sentence 36, verse 36. Page 79. As they were talking about these things, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, "Peace to you." But they were startled and frightened and thought they saw a spirit. And he said to them, "Why are you troubled, and why do doubts arise in your hearts? See my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have." And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. And while they still disbelieved for joy and were marveling, he said to them, "Have you anything here to eat?" They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate before them. Then he said to them, "These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled." Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures and said to them, "Thus it is written that the Christ should suffer and on the third day rise from the dead, and that repentance and forgiveness of sins should be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things." Here is the risen Jesus Christ, and he is in conversation with his disciples. And they are full of doubts, like us maybe. And he deals with their doubts so that they can have certainty. What he does is tell them where history is going. He tells them the facts, the evidence, and says it all points to me. His identity, his death, his resurrection. He explains it from history. He shows that the whole of history is pointing to him, his coming. Now, some people, they just talk about one thing. I don't know whether you know anyone like that. It's a new relationship or a new car or a new gadget or where they're going on holiday or football or work or something. People talk about the thing that matters most to them. And Jesus says it is exactly the same thing with God. He has one conversation topic. The Bible says lots of things in different styles and different ways. But one thing it points to above all else, and it is there in verse 46. Jesus says, all of it is pointing to me. All of Moses and the prophets, which is shorthand for the whole Bible, have one conversation topic. It is me, Jesus Christ. Now, I don't know what you make of that, but it is a pretty bold thing to assert, isn't it? Because Jesus isn't just claiming to be another person from history, like Henry VIII or Einstein or Picasso or whoever. He's claiming history is his story. It is about him. It is in particular, verse 46, about his identity as the Christ, the King, the one who has the right to be in charge, the one who is in charge, who rules the world. And his death, his resurrection, which, verse 47, makes forgiveness possible. If only we will turn around and come to him. Because he knows our hearts as well. He knows what we're like on the inside, our thoughts. He knows all of it. None of that is hidden from him, even if we manage to hide it from others. The trouble is, though, that they just don't get it. They can't see it. They don't get the Old Testament, they don't get Jesus. Until, that is, verse 45, he opens their minds so that they can get it. And it is the same with us. And at that point, all of this starts to get very personal. Because certainty is not just about knowing facts in my head, evidence, although it is about that. Ultimately, the facts point to are about a person. Christianity, when it comes down to it, you see, is about knowing a person, Jesus Christ, and having a relationship with, therefore, the God of history, Jesus Christ. Well, what are we to conclude from this? Well, in conclusion, let me ask this question. Who do we trust? Who or what do we trust? And is whatever we trust, or whoever we trust, more reliable than Jesus Christ? Can you trust them? Can you trust them with ultimate things? With your life, with your death, with your past, with your present, with your future.